Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Elmer Kelton's The Wolf and the Buffalo. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Ken Jackson, Tim Getman, Elliot Dash, Thomas Penny, Anastasia Wilson, Tony Nam, Jeff Allen, James Lewis, Evan Casey, Catherine Aselford, Donnie Stevens, David Coyne, Scott McCormick, Thomas Keegan, Christopher Graybill, Colleen Delaney, Dexter Hamlet, Richard Rowan, Gary Tells, Tim Carlin, Nanette Savard, Lily Beacon, and Mort Shelby. The Wolf and the Buffalo, Part 1. As dawn streaked yellow and orange through flat, low clouds to the east, Gray Horse Running, one of the Comanche, walked alone toward the nearest of the mountains. He was clad only in long tasseled moccasins and a deerskin breech clout dyed of blood red. A long-faced dog trailed after him, endangering the sacred mission. Should the dog profane the vigil site, and it almost certainly would, all might be lost. One of the darker spirits might put a spell over Gray Horse.
I said go home!
He hurled the rock and struck the dog a glancing blow along a bony hip. The cur turned back toward camp, tail between its legs. Gray Horse had no wish to kill it, for it was a favorite of his younger brothers. But he would if he had to. The medicine was too important to risk for a dog. Out of the gently rolling plains of western Texas, 100 miles beyond permanent white settlement, the dual promontories known on military maps as the Double Mountains pushed up like two ships adrift on a vast green sea of prairie grass. Many white men knew of them, but few had seen them. Randolph Marcy had mapped them in his exploration of 1849. Even earlier, angry Texas frontiersmen seeking vengeance for a Comanche raid deep into their new settlements had followed a trail carelessly left by retreating warriors who thought they were safe in their own homeland. Not far from here, the Tejanos had fallen upon a large village, leaving it a bloody, smoking ruin. But these penetrations had been rare. Even now, though watchful by their nature, the Comanches felt relatively secure in the shadow of these twin relics from an earlier geologic age. Landmarks long a guide for buffalo hunting bands making their way across this vast prairie. A few miles to the south, the red-bottomed Double Mountain Fork of the Brazos River snaked sluggishly southeastward to join the Salt Fork and the Clear Fork, forming one great river that meandered down through old Texas settlements. Washington on the Brazos, San Felipe, to spill its muddy waters into the Gulf of Mexico at Matagorda Bay. Summer had narrowed the river to a ribbon, its waters evil with salts and gyp. This band of the people had divided and strung their teepees along a pair of small creeks fed by sometime springs south and a little east of the mountains. The Great Horse herd ranged by day under a loose guard of young boys on a broad grassy slope reaching upward from the fork's south bank. The horses were brought together for closer guard by night. The Kiowas had been the people's allies for many years, and there was no fear of theft from that quarter. But to the west and southwest roamed the wily Apaches, blood enemies from so far back in time that no one knew why. Occasionally, they foraged this far onto the plains in search of meat and horses and Comanche scalps to win a claim in their scattered rancherias in those far, arid mountains to which the determined Comanches had long since driven them. Lesser men had invented the name the world knew them by, Comanche. Individual bands might be designated as the Buffalo Eaters or the Antelopes or the Honey Eaters, but the tribe itself had no name among its members. It needed none. They referred to themselves simply as the people. the true human beings, superior to all others and most favored by the spirits. Gray horse running trembled expectantly as first dawn touched the two mountains with fire. Up there, perhaps still sleeping, waited whatever spirit was to give him his medicine, his spiritual power for a life as a warrior and a man of the people. He was in his 18th summer, and he had prepared a long time. Now he and the spirit would meet, face to face. All summer, Gray Horse had stood his turn at guarding the herd, but last night he had been freed that he could prepare to seek his medicine. At the direction of the medicine man, comes down from the mountain, he had bathed in the creek so he could present himself clean in body and soul to whatever spirits might await him. He had smoked a bone pipe and had the shaman sing over him and paint his face and chest with symbols and colors. He looked back a minute upon the quiet camp, upon the row of buffalo hide teepees fronting the creek, all facing east. Smoke was rising through some of the wind flaps between the upper ends of the long poles that formed the conical shapes. He smelled cooking meat on the faint cool breeze from the east, and it stirred him to hunger. But he was not to eat today, nor probably for the 3 days that would follow. To find a beneficent spirit that would guide his life, a young man was required to fast as many as 4 days and nights in a solitary place where neither he nor the spirits would be disturbed by human activity. Sometime before the 4 days were over, if he were fortunate, he would receive a sign, perhaps a clear and unquestioned visitation, perhaps only a brief and ephemeral wisp of sound or shadow. Gray Horse's nomadic people, so often on the move, so often divided for months at a time into small family groups or warrior parties, had no organized religion, no central church, no priest. But they believed in a sure enough father who lived beyond the sun. Each person talked with him in his own way. The world was ruled by a variety of diverse spirits, some benevolent, some neutral, some dark and evil. Each man sought his own alliances with the supernatural, trying to obtain the blessings of one or more guardian powers that would guide and protect him. Until a young man had at least the beginnings of his personal medicine, some sign of approval by a good spirit, it was not wise for him to venture upon the war trail. He would be at risk to himself and to those who rode with him. No matter what his other skills might be, he had no real stature in the band until he had proven himself in war. Gray Horse had chafed a long time, rebuffed in his efforts to go on a raid. He had proven himself worthy otherwise. By his 10th summer, he was known as a superior horseman and had earned the name he now carried. 3 times he had joined the buffalo hunt and had pleased his family by good work with the short bow. But he had not been accepted for a war party because he had not acquired power. He would not be considered a whole man until he had counted coup, and if his guiding spirit was a strong one, had taken scalps of the enemy. There were many enemies to choose from. He studied the mountains intently as he walked toward them. He carried a buffalo robe, a bone pipe, and a plain bullhide shield without decoration. He had been weeks in preparing the shield, using the heaviest hide from shoulders of buffalo bulls he himself had killed. After an hour's walk, he stopped and spread the robe on the ground. He packed sumac into the bone pipe, fired a twist of dry grass with his flint, and lighted up, trying to put out of his mind any thoughts except of his quest and the careful instructions the medicine man had given him. He took 6 long puffs and blew smoke in each of the 6 directions, up, down, east, south, west, and north. Smoke was a messenger carrying the word of his coming. He sent it to the 4 winds, to his father beyond the sun, and to his mother, the earth. The shaman had told him to perform the ritual 4 times on the way to his vigil. After his 2nd smoke, he saw a flash of movement ahead of him. He saw a gray wolf scouting for rabbits or kangaroo rats or whatever else it might flush from hiding. The young man's heartbeat quickened. Traditions drilled into him from boyhood had conditioned him to watch for portentous signs. The Comanche had much respect for the wolf and rarely killed it. It was a great hunter, and a man fortunate enough to acquire the wolf medicine would be a great hunter too. The wolf was crafty and shrewd. It was accepted as fact among the people that a wolf could not be killed by guns, only by an arrow. If he observed all its rules, a warrior who had the wolf medicine could ride safely into the thickest of the battle, and the bullets would roll off his body as harmlessly as the rain. Grey Horse set out to follow the wolf at a respectful distance, far enough not to be in its way or to spoil its hunting, for he had no wish to make it angry and cause it to withhold its medicine. For a time, the wolf zigzagged across the prairie in its search. It stopped on a ridge and looked back. He had heard old men say that wolves had spoken to them in voices as clear as that of a brother. He listened, but the wolf said nothing. Or if it spoke, the distance was too great. Grey Horse stood a while after the wolf went over the ridge and out of sight. When it did not reappear, he walked toward the point where he had last seen it. It was gone. All he found was four tracks in a small patch of coarse sand. Four of the biggest wolf tracks he'd ever seen. He knelt and touched his fingers to one, hoping he might feel the power in it. It was a favorable sign. Perhaps the wolf had spoken to him in a way of its own. Time and the vigil would tell him. He paused a third time at the foot of the mountain, pulling grass burrs from his bare shins and spreading the buffalo robe among the boulders. The day's heat was beginning to bear hard on him. Sweat ran down his body, streaking the medicine man's paint. The climb was difficult, for the sides were often steep and the gravel was treacherous underfoot. Several times he started to slide and found nothing to grab. The shield and the buffalo robe complicated his problem, but they were essential. His growling stomach reminded him that he had not eaten. Deep breaths were like the cutting edge of a knife to his dry throat. Grey Horse remembered a cousin who had died on his quest for medicine. This boy had carried the protection of a shaman, but it had not been enough. The medicine of the malevolent spirits was stronger. The dark spirits had somehow deceived and distracted the lad and had sent a rattlesnake to bite him. The shaman said the boy probably had not followed his instructions faithfully and had nullified the protective medicine. Grey Horse was almost to the top when the loose gravel slipped beneath his moccasins. He slid on his stomach, moving faster as he went down. The sharp rocks gouged and ripped at him. He lost the shield, and he would have lost the robe had he not tied it across his back. Half numb, he turned slowly and carefully onto his side, anxious not to slide again. The leg throbbed and burned. He seemed unable to move it. If it was broken, he would probably die on the mountain. No one was likely to come looking for him before the fifth day. Fear threatened to smother him. In defense, he started singing an incantation the shaman had taught him, a song to draw benevolent spirits. His heart, racing at first, began to slow. He was able to feel the leg with both hands and assure himself that the bone was not broken. But his stomach and his legs were lacerated. In his left knee, where he had struck the sharp edge of the boulder, he found a deep gash, bleeding strongly. If the bleeding continued, it would surely weaken him. He would never complete the climb, nor would he be likely to get back down to the foot of the mountain by himself. He inched his way carefully to a small patch of short, dry grass. Pulling it up by handfuls, he wadded it tightly and pressed it against the wound. It took a while, but he stopped the bleeding. He sensed that the longer he stayed here, the less likely he could finish the climb. Soreness and stiffness were sure to set in. Painfully, he dragged himself upward, inches at a time. He came to the shield and hung it on his left arm, as he knew he should have done before. He resumed the climb, pausing often to rest. After a terribly long time, he dragged himself over the rim rock to the top. There he looked westward across a flat mesa. A sudden strong wind struck him hard in the face. It was a warm wind, almost hot, but it was good against his sweating body. The pain ebbed. This wind had come to him as a friend. Some malicious spirit had tried to stop him, but his stern will had bested it, and he stood on top. The signs were favorable. He spread the blanket and smoked the fourth time. By tradition, the Comanche looked to the east for good things. Gray Horse sat on the edge of the rim rock and faced eastward, settling down for what he knew would be a long and lonely watch. He had been taught that a true vision seldom came quickly, not the first time. For most young men of hardy constitution, it rarely came before the fourth day or night, when hunger had banished all minor affairs. Only then was a novice properly receptive, ready to see and hear and accept the true significance of subtle and fleeting things. He thought about the good warriors he had known and tried to visualize how the power must first have come to them. Few men were willing to talk at length about the experience, lest sharing of the knowledge diminish the medicine. Not even his uncle, who had been father to him since his eighth summer, had told him everything about his own quest.
When you are ready, you will be shown all you need to know.
Gray Horse sat with the afternoon sun hot upon his bare back. He tried to concentrate only on spirits and on the songs the medicine man had given him, but his youthful mind wandered as his gaze fastened upon the distant village. He remembered his previous vigils and his disappointment. Other men younger than he had been accepted to ride away with good warriors and strike the Tejano settlements, or to take the long and ancient war trail deep into Mexico, but he had been left with the women. He had long worried that his true father's ghost might be troubled about his failure. No one in the band had been more skillful at relieving his enemies of their horses than his father. The Comanche did not regard this as stealing. To appropriate property claimed by an enemy was not only honorable, but a duty. Many times, Gray Horse's father had stolen into an enemy camp and had taken horses tethered to Ute teepees or Apache wickiups or tied to a white man's picket line. That carried more honor than simply killing an enemy and then catching his loose horse. Other warriors had been eager to follow him because his raids were usually successful. They yielded many horses and many coups. Then came a time when it was deemed necessary to carry punishment to the Apache for an atrocity committed against a small Comanche camp. It was a matter of vengeance, blood for blood. Gray Horse's father had assumed the unquestioned leadership, and for this mission of honor he had taken an eagle feather bonnet never worn before in battle. The Comanches attacked boldly, but found the Apache force strong. Some warriors pulled back, afraid that their medicine was weak. Gray Horse's father stepped down from his war pony and plunged the point of his lance into the ground, a sign that from that spot he would not retreat. He cried for the others to rally, but the enemy swept over him as he chanted a medicine song. To their credit, his comrades did not leave him on the field to be scalped and hacked and robbed of the afterlife. Two bold men riding abreast had leaned down from their running horses and lifted him up between them, carrying him away to be buried with honor. The responsibility for the family had passed to the next oldest brother, Black Robe. The following spring, he had led eager young fighters into an Apache camp from which not one male over 12 summers had escaped. Among the trophies recovered was the blood-stained war bonnet. After that, following ancient custom, he had taken his oldest brother's widow to wife, though he already had a younger one of his own. He had taken Gray Horse and his brother and sister as his children, and their status in his eyes and in the family was the same as if they had been born to him. Gray Horse regarded him as his father, and his cousins as his brothers and sisters. So it had always been among the people. It was the only way they had survived the ages. All kindred blood was family. The man who would let family suffer while he could ride and hunt and fight was of low degree. Ebbing day stretched the shadow of the mountain across a long bench beneath him, then eastward to gentle the rough breaks and blend them into the rolling prairie. He was surprised to see a thin old buffalo bull out there, grazing alone, probably chased from its harem of cows by a younger bull in the constant struggle for prairie supremacy. He wondered how this aged bull had strayed so near the camp without one of the sharp-eyed hunters finding it. They surely would, sooner or later. A movement on the bench caught his eye. Two wolves paced across it. The larger, a male, was probably the one he had seen on his way to the mountain.
Brother Wolf! I am up here!
The big wolf gave no sign of hearing, or if he heard, that the boy was of any interest to him. Chances were that the pair had a den down there and were feeding young, if they were real wolves. If they were spirit wolves, they knew well enough of his presence, that he was ready to receive any message. Night came, dark and lonely. Following the shaman's instructions, Grey Horse spread the buffalo robe and lay upon it, then pulled it over his head. He lay awake, listening to the night wind crying across the mesa, to the crickets, to the birds who hid by day and came out at night to sing in praise of the moon. He faced east, that dawn might not catch him asleep and unaware. He had to be awake for the rising sun to give him its warmth and power. He did not sleep well. He was sitting up, waiting, long before color came to the eastern sky. He smoked and took all the power the rising sun would give him. His knee was stiff. The edges of the gash were beginning to puff and redden. When he had performed the rituals, he began a slow and limping exploration, looking for something that might heal the wound. He came upon a prickly pear plant. Gingerly, avoiding the bigger thorns, he cut away several of the pear pads, impaled them on a stick, and carried them back to his waiting place on the rim rock. Using a sharp-edged flint knife, he sliced a pad open, laid it across the gash as a poultice, and tied it in place with a soft leather string. Though he had cut away the large thorns, his fingertips were pierced by the tiny ones, most no larger than a human hair, but wickedly sharp and persistent. Doggedly, he forced his mind to concentrate on the powers he needed. He looked down on the bench, hoping for a glimpse of the wolves. He also looked for the old buffalo, but didn't see it. The day was long and quiet, and no vision came. Perhaps tomorrow, but more likely on the fourth day. In the afternoon, he removed the pear pad and found its pulp drained and almost dry, but there was yet much fever in the wound. He split a fresh pad and applied it. The whole leg was swelling and becoming sore to the touch. Night came, and the loneliness. He looked down toward the village, picturing his family singing or listening to his uncle father tell of his war adventures, stories the children knew by heart but always wanted to hear again, glorying in the stealth and skill and bravery they bespoke, the challenge they presented to the boys. He let some of the stories run through his mind, tales of havoc wrought upon the Apache and the Ute, tales of raids into the Texas settlements for horses, for cattle to drive onto the plains and trade to the Mexican Comancheros, for scalps and for female captives to ease the burden of work upon the people's own women, as well as to provide exotic diversion for the warriors who owned them. His uncle father had once brought back a pale-skinned, blue-eyed, and skinny creature who whimpered at every task the women set her to, and whimpered most when his uncle forced her under his robe. There had been no resentment among the wives, for a good provider was entitled to his amusements. His uncle father had finally traded the woman for two horses and a gray mule, confident that he had the best of the deal. He smoked and lay down for the second night. The leg troubled him, but exhaustion and the increasing weakness from thirst and hunger made sleep come despite the pain. Next morning, the start of his third day, he was down to the last pear pad. He tried to walk back for a fresh supply. He found the gashed leg so swollen and painful he made only a few hobbling steps. Fear teased him, Fear he would not be able to make his way back to the village even if the vision came. Fear he might die here from this fevered wound as his cousin had died from snake bite. He dragged himself back to the robe. Through the day, his eyesight blurred. His tongue was swelling from thirst, and he could not plainly sing the songs the shaman had given him. He felt a great heat, not all from the relentless sun. He lay on the robe, drifting in and out of sleep or unconsciousness. Once, just at dusk, he awoke to some kind of noise. He saw, or thought he saw, the two wolves pursuing the old buffalo. It had somehow hurt one foreleg and was trying to run on the other three. It kept falling on the rough ground, the wolves darting in and slashing at its hind legs while it swung its great black head about and tried to gore them. He could hear the angry bellowing, could see the blood trailing from its nose. He wondered, later, how he could see all this clearly when everything else was masked by swirling haze. He saw the old bull go down, bleeding slowly to death, while the wolves fed on his living flesh. This much was proven. The wolf medicine was stronger than that of the buffalo. Opening his eyes, he saw distant lightning. Uneasiness came quickly. The people feared few things they could see, but they feared the storm because its power and fury were beyond their control or comprehension. The fever was strong, the robe hot. Sleep would not come again. He thought he heard his name. He roused a little, listening. It came again. He heard no audible words, not a spoken language such as the people used among themselves. But someone or something was reaching his mind with a message. It was as if there were a transfer of thought from some other mind directly into his. He sat up, blinking at the lightning, trying to answer but finding his tongue swollen. He could not speak. Yet somehow he felt that his desperate thoughts were understood. In the flashes of lightning, a great form took shape in the darkness before him. Clearly, on the rim rock, he saw the great wolf. It was larger now than it had been before, larger than any horse he had ever seen, larger even than a teepee. It seemed to move around him in a circle, from south, around to the north, and back to the starting place, as a man customarily did upon entering someone else's lodge. Its steps were silent. It seemed to look directly into his eyes, telling him not to be afraid, for it had come to help a brother. It lowered its head and licked his wounded leg as a dog might do. Somehow the pain started draining away. In his mouth, the wolf picked up the unfinished shield he had brought, shook it a few times, and dropped it before Greyhorse. On it, he clearly saw the four wolf tracks he had seen that day in the dry sand, except now they were the red of fresh blood, stark against a field of black divided by the zigzag track of lightning, like those streaks now splitting the sky. From its edges flared a mixture of feathers from birds of four kinds. The eagle for its soaring majesty, the crow for its impudence and adroitness at theft, the roadrunner for its fleetness on the ground and the raw nerve which led it to attack even the rattlesnake, and the hawk for being fiercely protective of its nest against all enemies. From the bottom of the shield hung the tail of a buffalo. The wolf told Greyhorse to follow its ways in all important things, and he would have a medicine no man could defeat. He told him of the things he must do and the things he must not, that the medicine remained strong. Then, as quietly and quickly as it had come, the wolf was gone. When Greyhorse awoke, a cold rain was pelting his uncovered body. Where he had been fevered, he awakened to a chill. He drew the robe around him, but it was wet and cold. He was startled by the suddenness of his awakening and surprised that daylight had come. He huddled, shivering, trying to drive the clouds from his mind. The vision came back to him in memory as vivid and sharp as when he had seen it. To his joy, he found that he could remember every detail. This had been no fleeting dream. Quickly gone like a wisp of smoke on the wind. It had been a true vision, all the shaman had told him to expect and more. He looked around quickly, seeking visible proof to substantiate what he had seen, perhaps tracks of the great wolf. The rain had washed the ground clean, and the tracks were gone. The shield, it would show the wolf tracks in red, and the lightning, and the feathers. He stood up in alarm, fearing that the wind had carried it away. That shield was a vital part of his medicine. He could not lose it. He saw it lying beside a bush 20 long paces away. He limped quickly to it and grabbed it up, wiping mud from it onto the wet robe. At first glance, he was disappointed, for it showed no red wolf tracks, no zigzag lightning, no feathers. Slowly, the realization came that the wolf had not transformed it for him, but simply had shown him how he was to paint and decorate it for himself. It occurred to him that he was walking, though with a limp. Yesterday, he had hardly been able to move about. The leg was less swollen, less angry. He would never be able to tell the details of his vision. Some skeptic would say the wolf had existed only in his fevered mind, that the sensation of its licking his wound had been only the first falling of the rain. But he knew better. Along the hard edge of the shield, where he had stretched bullhide around a willow frame, he found deep scratches that had not been in it before. Tooth marks. In at least two places, the tooth impressions were plain. They had been left by a wolf. Not the great wolf of the vision, but a wolf of normal size. One of those from down on the bench. It had been here during the night and had tried to chew through the flint-hard hide. A chill came, not born of the rain. The wolf spirit had left a sign, one that would remain with him as long as he lived and carried his shield. He slaked his thirst from rainwater collected in a concave stone, taking modest amounts each time and going back until he was satisfied. He was weak from hunger. He thought of the buffalo bull. If it had not all been a fevered dream, he knew where it lay at the foot of the mountain. When the rain stopped, he slowly and carefully made his way down, carrying the pipe and the robe and the shield. He was not surprised when he found the slain bull stretched out as he had seen it in its final throes. A ravenous hunger took charge of him. Everything was wet. He could not build a fire and roast any meat. He would have to eat it raw. The bull had already stiffened, the body cold. At another time, Grey Horse would have been repelled, but now he was too hungry to turn away from even spoiled meat. He gagged at the off flavor, but managed to get it down. In light of the vision, he had no doubt that the wolves had made this kill as much for him as for themselves. His first hunger sated, he drank again from a shallow hole full of caught rainwater. In the vision, he had seen a buffalo tail hanging from his shield. He cut off the bull's tail high against the rump, splitting it partway down to make two strings by which he could tie it. He cut away excess cartilage and fastened the tail securely in the lacing which held the several thicknesses of hide against the framework. This, then, was another gift of the wolf. About to leave, he looked back speculatively at the carcass. This old bull just possibly might yield up one more piece of medicine. Grey Horse dragged out the paunch, split it open, and poked into its smelly contents until he found a ball of hair not quite as large as his fist. This hair, which the buffalo had ingested during a lifetime of licking its own heavy coat, would not pass through its digestive process, but instead was captured in the stomach and worked itself into a hard, round ball. These hair balls were widely regarded as having medicinal value. This one, Grey Horse was sure, would have stronger than ordinary medicine because it was a gift from the wolves, which had given him so much more. He would need a medicine bag in which to keep the hairball. He split the bull's stiffened scrotum, cutting the hide away from the testicles and scraping off the flesh. He put the hairball into it, gathered up his belongings, turned to stare at the mountain in a moment of reverence, then limped toward the village. He had come away from there a boy, incomplete and searching for the guidance that would point the direction of his life. He was returning a man, confident of his destiny. He possessed what he had hoped for, the medicine of the wolf. The last time Gideon Ledbetter had heard the chant of an auctioneer, one article of merchandise had been himself, body and soul. Now they were selling old Colonel Hayworth. Not his body, perhaps, but certainly his soul. Gideon remembered little from that other time except being frightened, tightly gripping his mother's trembling hand. Now he stood a bit short of 6 feet tall and was acknowledged one of the strongest men on the Hayworth plantation. But he still felt that old, remembered uneasiness. He quivered, listening to the rise and fall of a resonant voice droning strange words that made a peculiar rhythm but carried little meaning except an occasional, intelligible figure.
And now, you farmers!
He called out to a half-moon cluster of 200 people standing in the long, sloped front yard below the big white house.
We have here good spring wagon, Studebaker.
From there, the voice lapsed into gibberish that meant no more to Gideon than the Cajun French he often heard on this Louisiana delta. He took it for granted that the white people understood it, as they seemed to understand the French. At least they appeared to be having themselves a right good holiday, picking over the lifetime accumulations of somebody else. Old Colonel sat to one side of the auctioneer's makeshift stand in a straight-backed, cane-bottomed chair fetched down from his front veranda. The appellation Colonel was honorary. During the war, he had commanded a company of local militia, old men, boys, and cripples. They had never been called upon to do anything except drill. His spine was as straight as a ramrod, both his hands firmly gripping a black cane whose tip he had pressed 2 inches into the soft ground. Each stroke of the auctioneer's hammer was wiping him out, a piece at a time. The sprawling fields and the big white house were already gone. The parish government had confiscated them for taxes. Gone were the Negro houses and the barns, the thoroughbred horses, the orchard, the fine stand of cotton now setting its blooms toward a summer's crop. Going now was the farm machinery and the rolling stock. Sooner or later, they would even sell the chair out from under old Colonel. He would leave here, owning but one black carriage, one horse to pull it, and whatever clothing and personal belongings he could put into it and carry away. That, and the stubborn Hayworth pride he would take to the grave. Gideon's dark eyes clouded with sorrow as he watched two sweating black men who served as the auctioneer's helpers bringing up the tall grandfather clock he had listened to as a boy, marveling that it always knew when time came for Fat Aunt Ella to feed old Colonel and old Mrs. He glanced back at Big Ella and the other plantation help, standing in the shade of a moss-strewn oak a respectful distance to one side of the white crowd, which pressed in to bid or to watch, in morbid curiosity, the last small symbols of the Hayworth fortune passing into strangers' hands. Gideon remembered what Ella had told him a few nights ago.
It's the carpetbaggers and the scallywags. They run in the government now. They seize a farm they want, they just sets the taxes so high to where there can't nobody pay them. They keep shaking the tree, and when the apple falls, they grabs it. Black boy steals a pig, they flogs him. Carpetbagger steals a farm, they just smiles and says, help yourself to another while you're at it, like it was a piece of mince pie.
That all seemed true. They had sure got Colonel Hayworth's plantation. Hayworth held his ground until they began selling off precious things which had belonged to old Mrs. Her fine china, her powder box, her small collection of modest jewelry. He pushed up on his cane and strode toward the house. Gideon pulled away from the small group of house help and field hands, pushing his long legs to catch up to the old man. He waited until the noise of the crowd and the auctioneer were well behind him before he called.
Colonel! Colonel, sir?
Hayworth stopped, but he did not turn. He waited for Gideon to come past him and face around.
I was wondering, sir, if you got any special work you want me to be doing? You didn't tell nobody what you wanted us to do.
Almost as far back as he could remember, he had been asking old Colonel what to do. Hayworth had never encouraged his slaves, or after the war, his hired help, to think for themselves. In the first instance, he had never considered them capable. In the second, it was dangerous to let the serving class be self-sufficient. Only so long as they were heavily dependent would they remain manageable. The old man blinked. Gideon found himself unable to look into those sharp and blistering eyes. He looked at the ground, as he had been trained to do since boyhood.
Hell and damnation! Work! Damn you, boy! Haven't you got it through your woolly head that I've no longer got any work for you to do? I've got no place for you to do it! They've taken it all away from me.
I'm sorry.
Haworth's hands flexed on the curve of the cane. Gideon braced himself, half expecting the old man to strike him across the shoulders with it. But Haworth spoke again, and now it was old Colonel who stared at the ground. One vagrant tear rolled down the leathered cheek and lost itself in the carefully combed gray whiskers.
Oh, I didn't mean to speak so sharply to you, Gideon. You meant me nothing but good. I know that.
The colonel lifted his chin, staring at the white-columned old house built by his father in better times.
When that spectacle down yonder is over and all the vultures have taken their loot and gone, I wish you'd get Jimbo to hitch my good saw pacer to the carriage and bring it up to the house. And I wish you'd bring all the people, all my good old hands. And I'll have a few words to say before I take my leave of this place.
Yes, sir, Colonel.
Gideon stepped aside and watched in silence as the old man resumed his determined stride toward the front steps and the wide, vine-shaded veranda. Gideon had not always been sure how he felt about the old colonel, who was a changeable man of unpredictable moods. The same hand which administered the cane could sometimes be gentle. The eyes that flashed with an unreasoning fury could sometimes sparkle with laughter and even soften paternalistically. The man's sadness pressed heavily on Gideon as he walked to the barn. He heard someone running up behind him and saw Jimbo, the head groom, the only man on the place old Colonel trusted to take care of his prized thoroughbreds. Jimbo had literally grown up in the stables. He spoke two languages, English and horse. He usually spoke with a laugh.
What you fixing to do, Gid?
I'm fixing to tell you that after this is over, you should hitch old Colonel Sorrel to the carriage so I can take it down to the big house for him.
I washed the carriage this morning, shined it like it was a new silver dollar, soaped and oiled all the harness and groomed Big Red like he ain't been slicked up in a long, long time. I figured old Colonel would want to leave this place in high style.
It bothered Gideon that Jimbo seemed to take the situation for granted. Gideon had never quite accepted it. He had kept hoping old Colonel would find a way out of this trouble, as he had worked through and survived other difficult times. Gideon had been taught that the Lord would find a way to smite the transgressor, and he had held to a stolid faith that the Lord would smite the thieves who had stolen old Colonel's farm. Only now had that faith begun to crumble. Gideon walked up to the gentle sorrel and rubbed a firm hand along the strong neck, down to the muscular shoulder. He summoned courage to speak the doubt he had suppressed for days. He and Jimbo had been friends since boyhood. They had shared a bachelor cabin on Slave Row since both had been considered old enough. Gideon had always been able to speak his mind, Jimbo.
I don't know what's going to become of us.
We'll take care of ourselves is what. Old Colonel can't do it no more.
Gideon kept rubbing the sorrel's neck, letting his mind run free over things unthinkable before. After freedom, he had studied a while about leaving old Colonel. But Gideon knew little of what lay beyond this farm. The outer fences had more or less been his own outer limits, except for a dusty little cotton town 3 miles up the road. Life was not easy here, but it was familiar. He had stayed, trading freedom for the comfort of knowing what to expect most of the time.
I'm scared, Jimbo.
There's other places, Gid, better than this one. There's other farms we can live on.
They ain't home.
They will be when we get there.
The sun was low behind the big house when Jimbo brought the carriage around. Gideon loaded old Colonel's few cases and a trunk and a couple of boxes of goods belonging to Big Ella. Of all the hands and servants, only she would be going with old Colonel. Only she knew how to cook the things he liked in a way that wouldn't rile his touchy stomach. Gideon doubted that the old master would speak of it, for dependency on others wounded his pride. But he was going to live with a daughter and a son-in-law in Baton Rouge. The son-in-law was an attorney. When old Colonel came out onto the veranda, plantation men and the black women folk straightened to attention. Hats were removed and held in black hands. The subservient attitudes of slave times had not been put aside. His solemn gaze slowly moved from one face to the next until he had made the round.
Old friends?
He stopped, looking past the people.
I realize I've not always acted as if I considered you my friends, but I did, even in the old times.
He gritted his teeth and gripped his black cane.
The new owners will be here tomorrow. I have no wish to see them, so I'll take my departure now. I tried to persuade them to keep all the old help, but they want to be rid of you, because they're afraid you'll remain loyal to me instead of to them. I confess that this thought brings me comfort. I regret that it means a hardship to you. You all have served me well, and my lady in her time. I wish I could have served you better.
He blinked his eyes on Gideon.
On the floor in the parlor, you'll find a box with some envelopes. Please go fetch it for me.
Gideon could not remember that old Colonel had ever said please to him before. He paused a moment in the parlor, unable to accept its empty look. The floors bare of furniture, the shelves denuded of keepsakes and books. The feeling was that of suddenly finding himself in the midst of a graveyard. Stooping to pick up the box, he saw that each envelope bore handwriting. In slave times, it had been forbidden for him to learn to read or write, and in later years, he had somehow been too busy to consider correcting the situation. Tears rolled down Big Ella's round, ebony face. Gideon ached at the probability of being parted from her forever. His own mother had taken down during one of the fever epidemics and had died the third year after old Colonel had brought her and Gideon to this place. The task of looking after Gideon and pointing him in useful directions was left to Ella, in addition to her kitchen and general house duties. She had alternately switched him and loved him, as the occasion demanded. The loving always lasted longer than the switching. Hayworth drew the first envelope from the box.
I would like to have done better by you, but this country has been turned over to thieves who rob with a pen instead of a gun. The best I can do is write a recommendation for each of you. Take these letters with you. They may help you get work. You'll each find a few dollars in your envelope. It isn't much, but they didn't leave me much.
With each envelope went a handshake. Gideon watched in wonder. It was the first time he could remember ever seeing old Colonel shake a black hand. Done, Hayworth moved slowly across the veranda, stopping at the edge.
Go through the house and take anything you want. Take everything out of the cabins, because everything's yours. I don't care to see anything left for those carrion eaters except the bare walls. If I still had a young man's nerve, I'd not leave him even that. I would burn this place to the ground!
Gideon helped him into the carriage, then stepped up to pat the sorrel's neck one last time. Old Colonel beckoned to him.
Gideon, I hope you'll keep Jimbo with you wherever you go. He's a good boy, but he needs watching after.
Gideon nodded solemnly.
I'll do that, sir.
And Gideon, watch out for yourself. You're a good fella, too. But you have one failing that could get you killed. You've got a stubborn streak that makes you say what comes into your mind sometimes when you should keep silent. I've put up with it because I know you. Folks that don't know you, they may not stand for it.
I'll try to be careful, sir.
Big Ella saved Gideon for the last goodbye. Her cheeks were wet as she threw her big, soft arms around him and pulled his head down.
You boy, you remember the godly things old Ella has taught you. And don't you do nothing to shame me, you hear?
I hear you, Aunt Ella.
He was starting to cry, something a man his size was never supposed to do. Jimbo helped Aunt Ella into the back of the carriage behind old Colonel.
Get up!
Gideon stood at the bottom step, watching the blurred image of the carriage disappearing down the lane. Ella waved her hand as long as he could see her. Old Colonel never turned to look back. The dust had settled before Gideon moved, his envelope in his hand. He could feel coins. Jimbo had opened his, and he grinned, showing his strong teeth.
How much did you get, Gid?
I don't know. I ain't looked.
I got $20. I believe to my soul that's more money than ever I seen at one time.
Gideon didn't understand how Jimbo could smile, even if he did have $20.
Jimbo, why are you smiling? Don't you know we're homeless? We're about to be set out on the road like two pups that somebody hauled a long way off and dumped.
Jimbo only shrugged.
That ain't till tomorrow. I'll worry when I see the sunrise. You ever sleep in the big house?
Gideon looked up at the high columns and nodded.
Sure. After my mama died, Aunt Ella kept me in a little room off of the kitchen till she said I was too grown to be staying with a woman. That's when they put me and you together.
I've been on this farm all my life, and I ain't never slept in this house. I ain't even been in the house except when old Colonel called me up here to save herself some steps.
His eyes sparkled with wickedness.
I got a notion to sleep in here tonight, Gid. Ain't no white folks to say we can't.
We'd have to sleep on the floor. We still got good beds out in the cabin.
Floor'll do. I just want to be able to remember the rest of my life that I got to sleep in the big house.
Before his trouble, old Colonel would have whipped them off the place if he had known such a thought had entered their heads. Now, Gideon supposed, he wouldn't care. Even if he did care, he was gone. They gathered their few belongings out of the cabin. Gideon had a worn-out carpet bag Aunt Ella had given him. He supposed it might have belonged to old Colonel a long time ago, or to one of the Hayworths before him. Its colors had faded to a dull and lifeless rust and brown. Jimbo had never had anyone to give him a carpet bag. He rolled up his clothes and few personal belongings in his blankets, tying the ends with cotton rope. They fixed themselves a bite of supper. At dusk, they took a final look at the little frame shack.
We ain't leaving much come right down to it. You could pitch a dog through the cracks in the walls.
But they was our walls.
They was old Colonel's walls. He just let us have the borrow of them long as we done his work.
They walked up to the big house. Gideon had an odd feeling that about the time he had laid his hand on the doorknob, old Colonel would holler to know what the hell he was doing there. Jimbo started for the back door, as had been his habit when duty called him to the place. Gideon caught his arm.
The front door, Jimbo. If we're gonna do it at all, we'll walk right in the front door like we was company come.
The cavernous old house seemed even bigger now for having been stripped of its furniture and fixings. The wallpaper had light spots where pictures had hung, where tables and chairs and shelves had stood against the walls in one place for years upon years. The overall effect was more sad than scary. Though he had never really been a part of it, Gideon sensed that happy lives had been lived in this place. It seemed vastly wrong that this house was about to pass into the hands of people who knew nothing and cared nothing about those who had left their marks and something of their souls here.
Which room did old Colonel sleep in?
Gideon pointed to the broad staircase.
Up yonder?
That's where I'm fixing to sleep tonight. What about you?
Gideon shrugged.
One floor is about as hard as another.
Not so much as a lamp had been left. Gideon had not thought to bring a candle. He stood by the window through which the Hayworths had often looked down upon the big front yard, upon the oak-lined lane which led in from the town road. Jimbo stood at another window.
Yonder's the barns and the stables and all. I never knowed old Colonel could stand up here and watch just about everything I'd done. No wonder he gave me so much hell sometimes.
His face went solemn.
Reckon what them Yankee folks is gonna do with my horses. You reckon they'll take care of them, or you reckon maybe they'll turn them out and let them starve down? Or maybe sell them to pull a cotton wagon?
I expect they'll do whatever looks like it'll fetch the most money. Anyhow, it ain't your concern no more, Jimbo.
Yeah, them's good horses. I hate to think of somebody mistreating them.
For the first time, Gideon saw in Jimbo's eyes a reflection of the sadness he had felt all day himself. It took something special to touch Jimbo. Horses were always special. The two men lay in silence on the floor, staring into the darkness. Down on Cabin Row, an abandoned dog set up a howl. Another picked it up, and then another. Gideon listened for Jimbo's familiar snore, but didn't hear it. Jimbo was lying awake, too. Before sunup, Gideon carried the food sack down to the kitchen and stoked a fire in the big wooden range. There was no pot, so he boiled coffee in a can and mixed batter for hoe cakes. These he cooked on the flat top of the stove itself. By the time they were ready, Jimbo was there, staring blankly at the range.
That was fun. Sleeping in old Colonel's room.
Sure was.
In silence, they ate a skimpy breakfast, which leaned heavily to the coffee for strength. Neither man looked at the other. They gathered and rolled their blankets and moved out onto the veranda. As he blinked into the rising sun, Gideon saw a carriage pull up with two white men sitting in it. They were as surprised to see the two black men coming out of the big house as Gideon and Jimbo were to see them there. The taller of the men pointed a finger at Gideon.
Boy, you stop right there!
Fear clutched at Gideon's throat, caught where they weren't supposed to be. The situation summoned up a dread that went as far back as he could remember.
What are you boys doing coming out of that house? What are you trying to carry away?
Nothing, sir. Only what's ours. Just a few clothes, about all.
Open everything on the ground. Let's see what you have.
Gideon and Jimbo were slow to comply. The man jerked the whip from its stock and lashed it across both men's shoulders.
When I tell you to move, I mean move. And be damn quick about it.
The other man was pointing a pistol. Gideon's heart hammered. Never had anyone ever pointed a firearm at him. He spilled the contents of his carpet bag on the ground. He untied his little roll of two blankets. Jimbo had unrolled his blankets and dumped his clothes out. The men were not satisfied.
Your pockets. Turn your pockets inside out.
Gideon did, taking care not to lose the silver coins and the $5 gold piece old Colonel had given him in the envelope.
Is that money you got in your hand?
It's mine.
When the man flexed the whip, Gideon opened his hand to show him. The shorter man in the carriage looked at the money.
Probably found it in the house. Negroes don't come by that kind of money, honestly.
Gideon realized they meant to take it from him. He clasped his hand and held it behind him.
Old Colonel himself give me this money, sir.
The short man stood up in the carriage and held the pistol at arm's length, pointed straight at Gideon.
I'll give you something too, boy, if you don't hand that money here to me.
Fear clamped Gideon's throat. They would kill him without hesitation and without regret as an example to others. He opened his hand, but nervously spilled the coins.
Pick them up.
Gideon gathered the silver. For a minute, he couldn't find the gold piece. It was too much the color of the road. He realized the white men couldn't see it either. Agonizing in his loss, he handed over the other coins. Jimbo was slow in giving up his money. The tall man laid the lash across his shoulders and head until tears ran down Jimbo's face. Then he took Jimbo's money.
I own this place now, and I own everything on it. If you boys are ever seen here again, I have you shot on sight. You understand that?
Neither Gideon nor Jimbo summoned voice to answer. The short man grinned coldly and fired a shot into the ground between them. That frightened the horses and almost spilled him out of the carriage. The shot set a dozen dogs to barking down on Cabin Row. They came running out, some of them, to see what was happening and to challenge the intrusion. The tall man pointed.
Birchfield, this place is overrun with dogs. I want you to shoot every mongrel you see.
A lanky gray dog ran up, barking at the carriage. Birchfield's bullet buried itself in its ribs, just up from the flanks. The dog dragged itself off by its forelegs. Birchfield ignored its plight and aimed at a second dog. The dog died instantly. The rest of the animals scattered. The tall man reboarded the carriage and it rolled on down to the stables. The two men didn't bother to look back at the Negroes they had whipped. A job done right didn't have to be done twice. Jimbo sat on the ground. He had taken the worst beating. Gideon grimaced, looking at the mixture of blood and tears on a face meant only to smile. He felt his anger rising, not just for himself, but for Jimbo and for all the others left homeless by those men and the legal thievery they stood for. He watched the two white men striding into the stables to inspect their property. He clenched his fists, wanting to strike out against them, but not knowing how. He looked up at the big house, wishing old Colonel were still here. He would know how. The house. The idea burst upon him full-grown and complete with a startling suddenness. He was not accustomed to making decisions on his own or even initiating ideas of any real account. The old colonel had always taken charge. The enormity of the notion made him tremble.
Jimbo, old colonel told us if he had a young man's nerve, he'd have burnt the place down so them people couldn't have it. You remember him saying that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're young men.
Jimbo's eyes went wide.
You saying we fixing to burn the big house down?
To the ground.
Jimbo wrestled with his doubts, but his outrage quickly won. Whatever Gideon wanted to do had always been all right. He dusted his britches. The tears had stopped.
How are we gonna do it, Gid?
Old Colonel had always kept a barrel of coal oil in the backyard to service smaller cans used for filling lamps, for starting fires in the big kitchen, and in the several fireplaces that warmed the house in winter.
Let's gather up our stuff and skin around to the back.
Gideon kept looking cautiously toward the stables until he passed behind the screen of shrubbery and flowers. He pushed against the wooden barrel to test its weight.
Between us two, I believe we can carry it.
He dropped his bundle and carpet bag where he could pick them up in a hurry. He paused to plot their escape route across the cow pasture and out the backside of the plantation, where the moss-hung timber was thickest. He motioned for Jimbo to grasp the barrel with him. Together they picked it up, carrying it up the rear steps and into the kitchen. Gideon kicked the spigot open with the toe of his old boot. As the coal oil flowed, he pointed with his chin.
Around the walls. If we get the walls to going, I expect the rest will burn easy.
They carried the barrel through the rooms of the ground floor, spilling a continuous stream along the outer walls. They made three quarters of the distance when the flow thinned to a tiny trickle and then to vagrant drops. They set the barrel down where it had emptied. Beside the kitchen range was a small black shovel used to remove ashes. Gideon picked it up. He slid a round iron stove lid aside and scooped up a shovel full of glowing coals left from breakfast.
You skin out the door, Jimbo.
He gave Jimbo time to clear the steps, then pitched the embers into the puddle of coal oil. For a second or two, he didn't think they would take hold. Then flames shot up with the suddenness of a quail flushed from cover. The fire licked its way along the trail Gideon and Jimbo had made into the next room. Gideon cleared the back steps two at a time, going down. He grabbed up his carpet bag and rolled blankets, jerking his head.
Light out of running! They catch us, they'll shoot us like they shot them dogs!
Jimbo stayed ahead of Gideon until they pulled up for breath beyond the cow pasture fence. Shoulders heaving, they looked back on smoke, gray and black and brown, all mixed, climbing above the treetops.
We done it. Old Colonel'll be proud if he know what we done for him.
Gideon could not find it in himself to take pleasure. He looked at the smoke in sadness and anger and regret.
We didn't just do it for him, Jimbo. We done it for us.